From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and it is the biggest shopping day of the year, Black Friday, with the crush of shoppers. Many stores now open before today on Thanksgiving. Kohl's stayed open through the night. Dick's Sporting Goods opened at 5 a.m., Home Depot 6 a.m. Sarah Halzack is retail columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. She joins us from Washington. Sarah, the economy is doing well. Unemployment is low. What do you expect to see this year for holiday shopping?
I expect that we're going to see consumers out in full force. We saw that the back-to-school shopping season was pretty strong as well, suggesting that big retailers have momentum coming into this holiday rush. But a lot of the action is definitely going to be online. The forecasts are for 4.3 to 4.8% sales growth for the retail industry overall. But if you just look at the online piece, much stronger than that. 14.8% growth over last year is expected.
And how much of that is Amazon?
So we don't know exactly, but forecasts for the year overall suggest that Amazon is going to claim 50 cents of every dollar spent online.
Wow.
That's staggering. And the nearest competitor is quite far behind. And so this does underscore the extent to which Amazon just has this outsized power in the retail industry and is sort of leading these old school retailers to have to change their ways.
Well, and what about one of Amazon's biggest competitors, which would be Walmart? Do they do as well as that?
So Walmart is actually in the best shape it's been in quite some time. For a long time, Walmart stores had this problem where they weren't in stock on key items. There wasn't great customer service. The fresh produce looked icky, and they've really invested a lot of effort into fixing that. However, in the online space, they're definitely still dwarfed by Amazon. The way they're trying to compete, though, is by doing sort of a hybrid of online and in-store shopping. You may have heard of these click and collect programs where you buy something on your phone and then you drive to the store and pick it up.
Hmm.
Particularly in suburban and rural areas, we're seeing this as pretty popular with consumers, and so Walmart's trying to latch onto that.
Well, and one of the other things that we've seen this year is that there is just a race to the bottom in the world of free shipping, and these online retailers really trying to get people to make the decision not to go to the mall, not to go out to a physical store and just buy it, and you're not going to pay any more for it.
Exactly. And we're really seeing them. We've seen a move in that direction for some time, but it's really on steroids this year. So Target, for example, is offering free two-day shipping on hundreds of thousands of items with no minimum threshold. That's the first time that they've done that. And Amazon then responded by offering free two-day shipping on millions of items, even for shoppers who are not Prime members. So they're really trying to take out every last bit of friction to get you to open your wallet this season.
So the fear there, I guess, is that if they offer you free shipping and get you hooked and maybe even put some of their competitors out of business because of that, and then next year or the year after that decide, well, actually, we are going to charge 20% shipping or something like that, that would not be good for consumers in the long run.
It's true. And I think they are, they're definitely setting an expectation, right? And once they sort of open these floodgates, it's going to be very hard to then get consumers to pay for shipping again at some point down the road. And I think that what they'll end up doing is trying to offset the cost of free shipping in other ways.
Does this move to online make Cyber Monday kind of irrelevant?
Interestingly, it does not. So what we've seen is that while the deals that you'll see on Cyber Monday are probably not going to be that special, they'll probably be pretty similar to the deals you've seen throughout November and on Black Friday itself.
Mm-hmm.
We see that spending is quite concentrated in the online channel on Black Friday and Cyber Monday. So I was saying earlier that for the season overall, we're expected to see 14.8% sales growth online. Well, the growth on Black Friday and on Cyber Monday is expected to be more in the 17% range. So it's going to be the fastest growing day, and it's already the biggest day.
With all of this move online, are you worried that a lot of the good old fashioned brick and mortar stores are just going to go away? Or is there enough of a push by some to shop local and things like that, that they'll be able to stay in business?
There's no doubt that this push to online, what it's doing is forcing the retail industry to sort into winners and losers. And so I think that this push is going to be really difficult for a retailer like Sears, which went into bankruptcy earlier this year. But we see stronger retailers like a Walmart or a Target or a Macy's sort of slowly but surely figuring out how to navigate these changes.
And what about a mom and pop store?
So a mom-and-pop store, it could kind of go either way. On the one hand, retailers like Walmart and Amazon are providing very low prices, and the internet makes this new level of price transparency that we never had before, right? On the other hand, what we do see that might be beneficial to some small mom-and-pops is we see that consumers are gravitating towards niche and micro brands. Even think about the move away from big box gyms to sort of boutique programs like CrossFit or Orange Theory. People are liking things that feel unique, special, and distinctive, and that's something that mom and pops offer that is really hard for a Walmart or an Amazon to replicate.
I want to ask you one more thing. One of the stories we've been hearing about this year is that retailers are having a really hard time finding seasonal workers. They started way back in June hiring seasonal workers. Did they end up finding the people that they needed?
Yeah, so I think that they did. We haven't heard anything from them in the last couple of weeks that suggests there were problems on that front. But it certainly was a different kind of challenge for them than it had been in recent years, particularly in the wake of the recession. There were so many people looking for work that it was easy for them to make these hires. But, you know, you mentioned that folks started hiring earlier, and that was definitely a trend this year. We also saw them trying some different perks. So JCPenney, for example, is offering its part-time hourly workers a week of paid vacation this holiday season. And that's something that perhaps they wouldn't have done in the past. And I would say even things like, while Amazon hiking its minimum wage to $15 an hour, that wasn't specifically a play for the holiday season. It just more generally reflects that retailers have to step up their game to get talent right now.
That's Sarah Halzack, a retail columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as Black Friday shopping began in Birmingham, Alabama last night, a fight at a suburban mall ended with gunfire and several people wounded, one of them a 12-year-old girl. An 18-year-old suspect was later shot and killed by police. Shootings in schools and other public places have devastated many communities this year. We have a story now about a school shooting that didn't happen and the lessons that police and school officials learned from it. Houston Public Media's Laura Eisensee reports.
It can be the most dreaded news a parent can hear.
The worst grade school shooting in U.S. history, at least 27 dead.
That was 6 years ago at Sandy Hook. Then this February in Parkland, Florida.
We know 17 lives lost at a high school in Parkland, gunned down at dismissal.
And then in May, just outside Houston.
Welcome back, everybody, for our continuing coverage of this dark day in Santa Fe, that school shooting that left 10 people dead and 10 injured.
But as horrific as this list is, it would be even longer if it included school shootings that almost happened. The National Police Foundation has started a database of these incidents, and so far they've analyzed just over 50 school attacks that were stopped. I found one such case in Greater Houston.
How are you?
I'm good.
It's you, Tiffany Jefferson. I apologize for not.
Lieutenant Tiffany Jefferson is with the Houston Police Department. She works with Crime Stoppers of Houston.
On February 7th of 2017, we had a student that was a juvenile. He pretty much told his plans of placing bombs in a school cafeteria. And that student went on to say that when the bombs explode, the students are going to flee the building. They will be shot in the event they flee the building.
Jefferson says another student heard about the plan and called in an anonymous tip.
Crime Stoppers of Houston, how can I help you?
Crime Stoppers of Houston is a nonprofit that increasingly deals with school safety. Jefferson won't reveal the school's name to keep the tip line anonymous, and she won't identify the student because he's a minor. What she wants to emphasize, though, is they took this tip very seriously.
There was a campus officer that was immediately contacted by one of our Crime Stoppers investigators, and the juvenile who was identified was actually arrested for a third-degree felony and for terroristic threat, and they were charged.
Jefferson says later the school police didn't find explosives on campus. Still, experts say this case offers key lessons.
We have known that fellow students are an absolutely critical part of prevention efforts.
Marisa Randazzo used to work with the U.S. Secret Service as its chief research psychologist. Now she's co-founded a company that's helping Texas schools do threat assessments. Randazzo says in over three quarters of actual school shootings, the shooter told someone about his plans. So authorities need to hear from that someone.
When we can encourage students to come forward and let people know if they hear about something, like in this case, that someone's talking about planning to engage in violence at school, then it is quite possible to prevent, just like it has been done here.
In that 2017 case, Crime Stoppers had visited the Houston area high school months before the threat. In two sessions at the start of that school year, they coached over 2,000 teenagers on how to report tips. Ranyan Mancarios is Crime Stoppers' CEO.
What went right is that the student that reported anonymously had been trained and knew what to do.
But Mancarios says it was still a close call.
What went wrong is that the boy who made the threat had been operating under the radar. Until we came in and educated people, nobody knew what to look for. Nobody noticed that his language and activity had changed. So that's a problem.
Crime Stoppers, along with other state and national groups, are trying to reach more schools with lessons on what to look for so would-be shooters are stopped before they can act. For Here and Now, I'm Laura Eisensee in Houston.
That, of course, is the late Robin Williams as the genie in Disney's 1992 animated film Aladdin. A live-action version is set for next year. But if you can't wait, you can see the hit Broadway stage show based on the movie. It is touring the country right now. Michael James Scott stars as the genie. We talked with him when Aladdin stopped in Boston earlier this year. Welcome. And did you see this movie as a kid?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I mean, I grew up with the brilliance that is Aladdin. And as you grow up, you never forget, you know, the music and
right.
and the story. It's Aladdin. So, yes.
What do you remember about it?
I remember like the very first sort of thing when Robin Williams is like, come closer. Oh. Too close. For some reason, I just remember that.
Yeah.
And then, I remember, you know, A Friend Like Me.
Mr. Lancer, what will your pleasure be?
Let me take your order, jot it down.
You ain't never had a friend like me.
But I also, like, I did my first tap solo to A Friend Like Me, so I think that that's probably another big reason why I remember that particular song.
Now, for people who don't know this movie, whoever they are, or this play, you are a magical genie who helps Aladdin become a prince so that he can romance the princess Jasmine. And it is a role where you, like the late Robin Williams, have to talk, sing, change characters very quickly. I want to put you on the spot for a second and just have you give us a little taste of what you have to do in this show. Just, I mean, I'm sure that you know all of your lines and all of your songs, but give me a little bit of one of them. Anyone where you have to go really fast, because I was very impressed by that.
Well, like, if say I'm talking to you right now, and then all of a sudden I would switch to, ladies and gentlemen, now you're here on this game show, and we have to go into this. And then I would switch into something like, hey, y'all, we're here now, here in the lab. We're doing a little banjo band. I'm in the country music. Then I could switch and go into my full Beyonce mode, where I'm giving you a lot of this and that and that. But then I would switch right back. Into the, like, what do you think as a genie? So it's kind of, you think about a switch literally like turning the channel, which is kind of fun and exhausting.
I want to listen to a little bit of the genie that many know, and that would of course be Robin Williams. Here he is. He did a lot of improv in the film. Here he is during the song Prince Ali.
He's got 75 golden cows.
Don't they look lovely, June? Fabulous, Mary. I love the feathers.
When it comes
so
to
he's making fun of the Macy's Thanksgiving parade, which you don't do.
Yeah, we don't do.
No.
Yeah. So we go into the sort of Fats Waller, you know, Cab Calloway feel, which has more that more jazzy kind of a thing, you know. So this was for it to really feel like a parade, you know, of costumes and scenery. And as you'll see in the show, our ensemble changes four times during this number.
Right.
Which is insane. And they all come, you know, and then and what it's sort of representing is that, like, it's a different part of the parade. And I love this particular feel that we have in the show because that old school, you know, Hey, Clear the Way. It's such a throwback. It almost makes people a little bit surprised when they see and hear it because it's so different. The sound is so different. But this is kind of what it was originally intended to sort of be, is to have that old big band, you know, feeling.
What's your favorite song to sing in that show?
Gosh. I think... there are two moments for me. There's a new song that was written for the show called Somebody's Got Your Back, and it's in the second act, and it's with the genie and Aladdin and with Aladdin's friends.
How does that go?
And it goes, ain't it great to know somebody's got your back? Like, it has a very soft shoe kind of a feel, and I love to sing it. I love to sing it. And I also love A Whole New World, of course. I don't get to sing it. I sing it at the very end. I sing a little snippet, and I love singing it because it's just such a fun thing. You know, when you come out and you're a whole new world, that's where I'll be. It's just it's a beautiful moment. It's just an open feeling to get to do that.
Do you improvise a lot?
Yeah, I get to improvise a bit. And we kind of cater it for each, you know, city that we're in, which is kind of fun, and give some specific things for that city, which is...
When you were in Australia as the genie, you used to pull out some Vegemite.
I did. I pulled out Vegemite out of my pocket, which, of course, the Aussies loved, and it got a really, really big reaction and really big response, which is really fun.
Now, this is a role that you have played many times, including in Australia, and you're about to go play the same role in London.
Yes, yes. I never would have...
Is that because you love it or because they love you doing it?
Well, I think it's probably maybe a little bit of both. Uh-huh. I mean, I love doing it, and the opportunities have been continuing to come, which is incredible and such a gift. And I'm beyond thankful to the Disney team to sort of put me as, you know, kind of an international genie, which is kind of, I never, ever, ever expected and even imagined, to be honest with you.
Do the audiences in these different countries respond differently?
Yes and no. They all have the same love for it. You know, it's kind of like how, you know, music is a universal language. I feel like Aladdin is like the universal show, you know, where people just love it so much and they want to love it. They want to love you, you know, and as the genie, I mean, you know, as an actor, like, that's kind of really cool that the audiences want to love you, you know. So I think that the love is the same everywhere. The differences are just sort of how the jokes land and where people laugh, which is always great for me as an actor to learn, and such a great learning experience because it's so different in every country.
You've also been on Broadway. You originated the Maggots guy in the hugely popular The Book of Mormon.
I did.
Who
yes.
is the Maggots guy?
My mother
remember.
Is very proud. The doctor, he's actually the doctor, but he sings about having that in his, he sings about having maggots in his.
Can you do it for us?
Am I allowed to actually say it?
Go, do it. We can bleep it. I think you can probably say that. Okay. And then I want to ask you about another role.
Yeah.
You were the minstrel in Something Rotten.
Yes.
And we have some of you singing Welcome to the Renaissance.
Oh. Welcome to the Renaissance, with poets, painters, and bon vivants, and merry minstrels who show the streets of London a strum in their lutes,
in puffy pants and pointy leather boots.
Welcome to the Renaissance, where we ooh and ah you with zombies. We're so progressive.
You want to complete the song for us? Go for it.
Yes. With much ado, welcome to the Renaissance, where everything is new.
What do you like doing the most, by the way? Because you have to sing, you have to act, and you have to dance.
Oh gosh. I mean, I love them all. I truly grew up singing in church. So singing was the first thing that I did in my I say this all the time, but my mother said I sang before I spoke. Mm-hmm. So singing is it's just within me. And I come from a family with lots of music around. So singing is amazing, but there is no feeling like dancing though, too. You know, like when you get a big dance number to get to really like, do you know what I mean? My inspiration is like Fred Astaire, Gene Kelly, mm-hmm. Ben Vereen, Sammy Davis, like those cats are like, that's everything for me. So to be able to get to dance that as well, I don't know. There's something about it that I love, and it feels so freeing to get to do.
Do you prefer to tour or to do this on Broadway or in one place?
Oh, gosh, I love it all. You know, it's different when you're on Broadway because it feels a little bit like, you know, because you have your life and you're going to work. And, you know, it's weird because when I say work, I never ever thought that I would be going to work to be doing a show. Mm-hmm. So it feels strange when you're sort of like in New York, because that is, it's like you go and you sleep and then you go to work, you know. But on the road is different. It feels a little bit like you're on a vacation. You know, you kind of get to hang out with a bunch of, your family is basically around you all the time. You know, your whole cast and the crew, like we're all together all the time. So it feels like a fun little vacation.
How long do you want to keep being the genie?
I'll be the genie as long as I can do it. As long as my body will let me do it. Good Lord. But I love it. And, you know, when you play the genie, if you're having a bad day and you come in to play the genie, it's the best medicine for you to get rid of all of that and get to come in and play a character with so much light.
Michael James Scott, before we let you go, I am going to ask you to sing something from Aladdin. I tried a few times. It didn't work, but now I'm going to directly ask you to sing.
All right. All right. All right. All right. Wah, wah, wah. Ooh, wah. Wah, wah, wah. No, no. Wah, wah, wah. Ha, ha, ha. Well, Alibaba had them 40 thieves. Scheherazade had 1,000 tails. Well, master, you're in luck, because up your sleeve, you got a brand of magic never fails. You got some power in your corner now. Some heavy ammunition in your camp. You got some punch, pizzazz, yahoo and how. See, all you got to do is rub that lamp.
It's Michael James Scott, who stars as the genie in the touring production of Aladdin. We've got more information on the show at hereandnow.org. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Michael James Scott speaking with us last July. He has since returned from his run as the British genie to the touring production of Aladdin here in this country.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Indian authorities are trying to figure out how to recover the body of a young American missionary who was killed on a remote Indian island by a tribe that has resisted the outside world for thousands of years. Before he was shot with arrows and buried by the tribe on the beach, John Allen Chow wrote that he thought God was protecting him from authorities who try to keep people from visiting North Sentinel Island. Joining us now is Jill McGivering, BBC South Asia editor. She's in London. Hi, Jill.
Hi there.
So what more do we know about the circumstances surrounding his death, and what was he doing there?
Well, the authorities are being a little bit cautious about saying very much. You can imagine this is extremely sensitive. But we are hearing a little bit of information from the fishermen who apparently were paid by John to take him out to this area. They say that he'd made several attempts to go out to North Sentinel Island to make contact with this group, and that in this particular instance, he took a canoe with him and went from the fishing boat to the canoe and managed to land. That in itself is actually geographically a little bit difficult because there's a big coral reef which is one of the barriers that's been between the outside world and the Sentinelese people. The fishermen say that almost as soon as he set foot on the sand, he was attacked with arrows and appeared to die. And then one of the issues now is really verifying exactly what happened and also retrieving his body, which is still there.
But it seems clear from what he wrote before he died that he knew that he was in danger going to this island.
Yes, I think he was very aware of the dangers. This tribe in particular is known for being the most uncontacted and the most hostile to contact of all the many tribes in this area. We're talking about a very, very remote area. There are about 300 islands, basically right in the middle of the Bay of Bengal. And in terms of things like flora and fauna, you're thinking more Burma and Thailand and Indonesia than really India, but it comes under Indian jurisdiction.
What more do we know about the people on this island?
There are quite a lot of photographs of them that have emerged sort of from very long distance. But obviously it's difficult to know a lot about their way of life. There are thought to be between 50 and 150 of them left. It's thought that they may have been living on that small island, which is described as being around the size of Manhattan, for something up to 55 or 60,000 years. So possibly the oldest uncontacted tribe left on the globe. There have been attempts in the past to contact them, but they have been very hostile to anyone attempting to engage with them and have given a strong sense of they want to be left alone. They're quite physically small in stature. They're almost unclothed. They just wear something that looks a bit like a loincloth. And they have very dark skin.
So at this point, the task to try to get John Allen Chau's body back, that is not going to be easy. Indian officials don't even travel to this island. Can his body ever be recovered?
It presents the authorities with a tremendous dilemma, I think. Partly it's to do with culture. In a way, it's to do with diplomacy and the respect that they want to show the family. There may also be practical issues. One of the concerns about maintaining this no-contact rule with many of the tribes, but this one in particular, is to do with the risk to them of having any contact with people from another part of the world, because they do not have immunity to things like, you know, the basic common flu or common cold, syphilis, all sorts of things. There have been in the past instances where the tribes have made some contact and large numbers of them have died. And as I'm saying already with this tribe, we're talking about dwindling small number of people.
That's the BBC's South Asia editor, Jill McGivering. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
The midterms aren't over yet. In Mississippi, Democratic former Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy is still trying to unseat Republican Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith. It's a seat she took over from GOP Senator Thad Cochran, who retired earlier this year. Neither candidate succeeded in getting above 50% of the vote on November 6th, which is why they are squaring off again on Tuesday, November 27th. Because of a lack of polling, who will win the runoff is anyone's guess. Hyde-Smith was favored in the beginning, but due to a series of gaffes, some think Espy is looking stronger. For more, let's bring in Jeff Pender, political editor at the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, Mississippi. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, good morning.
So both candidates have agricultural backgrounds, both trying to do historic things here. Hyde-Smith became the first female senator from Mississippi when she took over Cochran's seat. Espy would be the first black senator to serve Mississippi since Reconstruction. Let's hear a little bit about the candidates, starting with Hyde-Smith, and we'll get to the scandal that's all over the news in a few minutes. But first of all, tell us about her. She's been only a Republican since 2010.
Sure. She served, I believe, three terms in the state legislature as a Democrat, although as a Democrat that frequently voted with Republicans, it should be noted. She switched parties in 2010, probably a pragmatic decision as much as anything else to run for statewide office. She ran as a Republican for state agriculture commissioner, won election and then won re-election before being appointed in April to temporarily replace Senator Thad Cochran, who stepped down.
And what about Mike Espy? What should we know about him?
Sure. He was first elected to Congress. He was our first African-American to serve in Congress. In the House since Reconstruction as well. He won re-election three times in the House, was appointed in 1993 as U.S. Agriculture Secretary. another historic first African-American to hold that post. Mm-hmm. Both candidates do have strong agricultural ties and strong support in rural Mississippi as a result.
So race has been a big issue in this campaign after several pictures and videos surfaced of Hyde Smith. In one, the one that's been out there in the news, she can be heard praising a supporter by saying, "If he invited me to a public hanging, I'd be on the front row," which for many conjured up Mississippi's historic past when it lynched more people than any other state in the union. Right. Here's Hyde Smith at a debate this week defending that comment.
You know, at a campaign event, I had the opportunity to visit with a supporter who has a big piece of my heart. See, his mother and dad both died of cancer when he was in high school. So to express my deep regard and my sincere commitment to this young man, I used a phrase. I told him that I would fight a circle saw for him. Well, obviously, I would not stick my arm in a circle saw, nor did any of my comments ever mean that I would enjoy any type of capital punishment sitting there witnessing this.
Okay, so that's her answer there. You were at that debate. First of all, what is she talking about with a circle saw?
I think her claim in this is that she essentially used a couple of very hyperbolic, in one case, very obscure and old colloquialism. You know, I think there is an old saying in the South, someone so mean or tough they would fight a buzzsaw. She used some variation of that, saying she would fight a circular saw for this guy, then went on to use something a whole lot less common or ever heard, that if he invited her to a public hanging, she'd be on the front row. Again, she said this was just, her use of an obscure, as she put it, exaggerated comment of regard, I think is how she has been describing it.
But you've never used that phrase as somebody in Mississippi.
I never have. I'm a native Mississippian, been here all my life. I had never heard that one. Mm-hmm. Various folks have done some research. Apparently it does appear at some point in the 1800s, but I don't think it's something commonly used now. And as many, many people have said, just a poor choice of words given our state's dark history.
Well, she said that people had twisted her words. Here's Espy responding to that.
Well, no one twisted your comments because the comments were live. It came out of your mouth. And I don't know what's in your heart, but we all know what came out of your mouth. And it went viral, within the first 3 minutes around the world. And so it's caused our state harm. It's given our state another black eye that we don't need. It's just rejuvenated those stereotypes, that we don't need anymore.
What's happening with this whole controversy? What do you think it's going to do to the race?
It's obviously, from what we've heard, it's tightened the race up. I mean, this is a very red state, and that seat was considered very safely Republican. From some reports now, it sounds like that's not quite as much the case, that this comment has apparently moved the needle a few points, making Mr. Espy a little more competitive.
But, well, and everybody remembers Alabama and that special election, and Doug
sure.
Jones, the Democrat, managed to defeat Roy Moore, the Republican. Now, when you look at the demographics of Alabama and Mississippi, Mississippi actually has a lot bigger black population than Alabama does.
Yes. Yes. I believe Alabama maybe below 30%. We're in the 37-38% range. Mm-hmm. They're in the 30% range.
So if he could mobilize African Americans in a big way, Espy could win this race.
Sure, sure. This race, it's an odd race for a number of reasons, but one primarily being it's a runoff the Tuesday after Thanksgiving.
Right.
It's the last race hanging in the country, and turnout is going to be key. At this point, I don't get the feeling either campaign is trying to win hearts and minds. They're trying to mobilize their base and get turnout. Runoff votes are typically low turnout affairs to begin with. When you have one in the holiday season, otherwise not much going on, it's even more of an issue. In the primary for this race, we saw extremely low turnout, 13%. We ended up in the general election, it's a special election, ended up with actually higher than normal, almost record-breaking for a midterm election turnout. So it's really hard to tell what's going to happen on the 27th.
Well, and there's a lot of outside money now coming in, right? Tell us about the outside influence on both
sides.
Yes,
yes. I think through the general election, there was only moderate interest, particularly probably on the Democratic side. Again, this was viewed as a safely red seat. Once it's gone to a runoff, there's no other game in town, so to speak, and particularly since these comments may have seemed to move the needle in the race, we've certainly seen the Democratic Party has late in the game sunk a lot of money into this, of course, the Republican Party as well. We've seen a race that was pretty mild to begin with now all of a sudden is totally amped up, and we're being bombarded with third-party ads nonstop.
So on election day, Hyde Smith and Espy both got about the same amount of the vote, just around 40%.
But there was 41%.
41%. Yeah. There was another candidate, another Republican candidate, who got about 15%. So is it likely, though, that a lot of that vote is going to end up going to Hyde Smith? Or are those people who said, I don't want Hyde Smith, and that's why I'm voting for this other Republican?
Well, that's a big question. Again, we're referring to Chris McDaniel, who's basically an anti-establishment Republican candidate, big Tea Party support. And all of his support going to Cindy Hyde Smith is not something to be taken for granted. A lot of anti-establishment, drain the swamp sentiment there. He has endorsed her. But again, all of his support could be likely a lot of his support just doesn't turn out more so than potentially voting Democrat. But her receiving all of his support is not a foregone conclusion.
Well, we will see what happens on Tuesday in Mississippi. Jeff Pender, political editor at the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you.
That scratchy sound you hear comes from a violin. No special effects, just a bow on strings. The sound is produced by a technique called the chop. The chop arrived on the music scene about 50 years ago, and slowly, this odd little noise has taken the fiddle-playing world by storm and changed the way the instrument is played today. Amelia Mason from member station WBUR explains.
So you can get some nice kind of ska rhythms going. Basically, what we're getting here, we're modeling the hi-hat and snare of a drum kit.
That's Daryl Anger. He's a fiddle player, one of the best in the world. I've caught him at his soon-to-be former home in Arlington as he prepares to move back to his home state of California. Right now, he's in full professor mode, keeping a running commentary as he demonstrates a technique that he's become known for, the chop.
It's like almost like the point of the shovel going into the dirt or something. The bow comes down, sits on the string, and then you get another sound by kind of bringing the bow back up off the string thusly. So I'm actually just
Anger makes the chop look simple, but that small sound has kind of defined his career. In 1985, he co-founded a group called the Turtle Island String Quartet in San Francisco.
We wanted to do everything. We wanted to, in the context of a string quartet, we wanted to prove that string quartet was capable of any kind of music, even contemporary music. And so the chop became, the drums and bass and rhythm guitar.
Anger developed the chop into a really versatile rhythmic tool. Today, it's everywhere, in bluegrass, jazz, and Celtic music. When I was learning to play the fiddle as a teenager in the early 2000s, chopping was huge. Since then, I've wanted to know, how'd that happen? How did someone figure out a totally new way of playing an instrument that's been around for centuries?
My name is Richard Green, and I'm the infamous inventor of the chop, which is now utilized by virtually millions of fiddlers around the planet. And obviously, I'm a little bit proud of that.
Richard Green is a fiddle player from Los Angeles. He got one of his first gigs back in 1966 with Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys. But Green says he wasn't very good at the fiddle. He kept rushing the music. So Monroe told him to stick with rhythm, which was physically demanding and hard to keep up for very long.
So I dropped the bow on the near the frog as a way of just resting my painful wrist and arm.
By the way, the frog is the end of the bow that you hold.
And then when I would lift the bow up, there was a free sound, the pinch on the string. So that was how it began. Drop the bow and pinch, and it takes no energy whatsoever. The mother of this invention was pain and laziness.
After his stint with the Bluegrass Boys, Green helped found a band called Sea Train. And that's where he began incorporating the chop into more complex bowing patterns. Daryl Anger remembers seeing the band in the early 70s.
He was using it as sort of this bravura kind of solo thing. Like the band would stop and he'd like go crazy and he'd chop all over the place. It was great. And then the band would come back in and people would scream and, you know, just do whatever it is people do when they're in ecstasy. And I was in ecstasy. It was amazing. It was like it changed my life. You
know? Soon, Anger was using the chop and teaching it to friends, who taught it to their friends. By the 2000s, the chop was a full-blown phenomenon. It had a huge presence in Boston and traveled from the U.S. to Canada and Europe. It was also sort of a hot-button issue. Some musicians thought it was too modern. Others found it showy and obnoxious. But chop inventor Richard Green says it's really just part of a trend in acoustic music toward experimentation and, well, noise.
The world of noise is now added to the world of musical instruments. It's great to add noise to fiddle, to the violin. It's a great thing. It gives it some life, gives it some grit.
It's Tuesday, Bluegrass Night at the Cantab Lounge in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Things are winding down. People are milling around in the half-lit bar. Fiddler Patrick McGonigal has just finished playing.
I was chopping. I was doing two different types of chop.
McGonigal says when he first learned how to chop, he used it all the time. But that started to get old, and like a lot of people, he uses it sparingly now.
Daryl Anger had a great quote once, which was, teaching people to chop is like giving people a knife. It's a very useful tool, but it's also very dangerous if used improperly. And I feel like that's kind of how I think about the chop.
Do you think it's here to stay?
Oh, for sure. 100%.
Maybe the chop is the auto-tune of the string world. For a while, it was all the rage, and you either loved it or hated it. And now, like electric guitars and synthesizers and holograms of dead pop stars, it's just part of the landscape, like it's been here all along. For Here and Now, I'm Amelia Mason.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.